You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
OTBAM, we're here bright-eyed, bushy-tailed for a Monday morning after an amazing weekend of sport. I'm joined by my fellow Galwegian, who is really surprised I'm from Galway, Johnny Ward, is after accusing me of being from Kerry.
Yeah, I got that all wrong. Bushy-tailed, tiger analogy going on there, or, you know, is it some sort of animal link?
No, just
bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Just bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
You were eating a Kit Kat there at 7 o'clock this morning and you've had a Diet Coke already. That's a hell of a way to start a week.
That's kind of how I roll.
I'm admiring it. I'm a very much a, my coffee machine has just actually broken down the last few days, and it's really not good at all in terms of my mental health. I get up in the morning, it's like I've definitely an addiction to coffee, and I can't have any coffee.
I always have like cans of Diet Coke in the fridge. People would say it is an addiction. It's not an addiction. It just wakes me up in the morning. It fires me up.
Sounds like an addiction.
No, but it only has to come from a can. I will not drink Diet Coke from a bottle. It has to come from a can, and I never finish the can.
Getting back to the main point, though, you're from West Galway and I'm from East Galway, so it's a nice Galway theme to the show today.
Yeah, I think we should just drop everything we've been talking about. Forget about Tiger Woods, forget about everything else. We just talk about Galway.
Absolutely.
For 2 hours.
We are a great bunch of lads.
We are. We're absolutely great.
We are. We're Galway City is a fairly cool place. Like, we're quite isolated in the West, but we're proud of where we're from, but we're very outward looking as well. Very cultured, lots of sport going on. We've rugby,
artistic,
like a few pints.
Bit of crack.
A few bottles of Buckfast when we were younger, that sort of stuff. And
did you ever do the Buckfast down, did you go sparching down with the Spanish Arch?
No. I didn't live in Galway City ever. Like, I left Galway, East Galway, when I was 17, and I'm up here 20 years now. So I never had really the living Galway experience, which I do regret because Irish Times has just been thrown at me here. But I do regret that I never lived in the city because I remember back in the days before I studied journalism, there was a book out on colleges to go to in Ireland, and I remember the line about Galway was, the problem with Galway is eventually you'll have to leave.
Yeah.
And that was the city life there, and I'm just not sure. But at least in Dublin, you kind of had some element of responsibility. Galway, just you'd be having the crack the whole time.
You were, yeah. Even though it was always raining, that was the worst thing. Like, it always rains in Galway. I didn't realise until I moved to Dublin that I actually spent the first 25 years of my life damp.
It's unbelievable. I think it rains about twice as much in the West as, like, my father rang me last night and he was giving out about the weather, and I was saying, like, it really hasn't rained here. Now, it rained obviously this morning, but my flatmate was home in Sligo and she was giving out how much it was raining at the weekend. In Dublin, it's almost like a British climate compared to the West, which I would consider an Irish climate, where it just rains an awful lot. I was watching.
You're just accusing all of Dublin now of being West Brits.
The climate is probably more that you would expect. It's more London than Connemara in many ways. Like, if you live in the west of Ireland, it rains an awful lot. I mean, we've a couple of people here from the west, and you know, maybe from Sligo and from Galway. Eamon Sweeney had that great book, There's Only One Red Army, and he spoke about how much it rained in Sligo, as living and being brought up in Sligo. And you don't appreciate it if you live in the east at all. We were very blessed. Like, I think if you walk to work in Dublin, it might rain 7 days a year on average on your walk to work, which is nothing really, and it's probably a lot less at the moment. In Galway, I'd say it's closer to 20.
I remember when I was in college in Galway, you'd be walking up, I say people are probably sick of listening to us now, except people who live in Galway, walking down the Quincentenary Bridge, and you'd be soaked. And it was the early noughties where people were still wearing the bootcut jeans, and your jeans would be soaked up to your knees, and your duffel coat would be manky, and you'd smell like wet dog. Whereas now I'm walking, I get the Lewis every morning now into RCSI every morning, and I count on one hand the amount of times I took an umbrella. You couldn't bring the umbrella out of Galway, it'd be inside out.
I remember walking to Galway Roscommon in the Connacht Championship a few years ago, and the traffic in Salt Hill is so bad. Like, it's the worst situated sporting ground in the country, I'd say. Never should have gone in there. Should have redeveloped Tomb Stadium for football, absolutely.
Killarney's is bad.
I'm right on this. But anyway, I was walking towards the game, and I think I'd been out the night before, and there were three very Galway-looking lads walking against me. This is at about 12 o'clock, half 11 in the morning. They were just kind of swigging off Buckfast. And they looked at me and they go, would you take a swig there, laddie? And I was like, no, it's a bit early for that. And he goes, you're only a wimp. And he just walked off. And I was like, I was called a wimp for not drinking Buckfast at half 11 on a Sunday morning in Galway. And it's just the most Galway kind of experience you could have. But it's a great city.
It is. And I'm getting yelled at now by Tommy to move on and stop talking about Galway.
No,
If anyone has any Galway memories, feel free to tweet them in or message us 53106 or add off the ball, because we'll talk about Galway all day.
Tommy
is telling me to talk about the greatest sporting comebacks. Some lad called Tiger Woods.
That involved Galway. fair play to Tiger, yeah. You know, notwithstanding like his personal problems throughout, you know, the last whatever 15 years, just the fact that he'd all but given up, I think he's an inspiration to a lot of people. I mean, you look at Augusta yesterday, it's basically golf fans. These are very well off individuals generally. You know, it's one of those tournaments that I wouldn't necessarily want to, because I love football and I love, you know, Gaelic games. It's very much for everyone, working class up to whoever else. Golf, to me, is not like that. I would associate golf with kind of prestige and kind of wealth and all that. And Tiger's a very wealthy man, but he's a very troubled character throughout his life. You know, if you ever read that ESPN piece on him. So what he did yesterday is inspirational. You shouldn't give up. And just the outpouring of emotion at the end, where he, by all accounts, he'd never behaved like that before. But if you have 11 years of hurt, you're entitled to kind of let yourself go.
Some of it's self-inflicted.
Absolutely, like I think the thing with Tiger is he's flawed. He's very flawed.
That's probably why people like the story, because
absolutely, like, as privileged as he is, and you know, Nike stood by him, and he's a multimillionaire or whatever amount of money he has, that really doesn't matter. And if you saw some of the footage of his off days over the last 10 years, which I watched last night, and the just frustration that he was feeling, and he'd probably all but given up. And I was sitting here with John Duggan. Probably this day last week, if not Tuesday, and he was just talking about Tiger, but he said like he's not practicing as much anymore, and you'd have to worry about him sustaining it for the 4 days. But he was like a machine, and you could see that he'd kind of rid himself of emotion. You just watched him; he literally just looked like a machine who was focused on one shot to the next, get one hole to the next. And it was only really when he got to the green at the 18th, when he still wasn't technically over the line, that he could kind of let himself go and realise where he was. But I think he rid himself of he became a functioning machine that just did what he had to do. And it was remarkable to watch Molinari, like that shot at the 12th, and Koepka's miss at the 17th, just to kind of, you know, make it drag on a little bit more. But it was hard not to be inspired by it.
Well, you mentioned he was like a machine. The Twitter machine has been busy, just some people giving in their suggestions about greatest sporting comebacks. We have Michael Foley there, and you can see it up on the big screen there as well. Tiger's comeback, incredible. Doesn't mean Niki Lauda coming back from being burnt alive in a Formula One car to win the Drivers' Championship the following year. Or Ben Hogan surviving a near-death crash to win 6 majors. A 2-drink minimum conversation, I reckon, maybe at 11 a.m. with Buckfast in Galway. I don't know.
And a Kit Kat.
And a Kit Kat. I have to have the Kit Kat and maybe wash down with a Diet Coke. Yeah. Andy Lee, Daniel Jacobs coming back from bone cancer to become world champion has got to be up there with the best. Paul Bowden also suggesting Andre Agassi went from world number one to number 141 and back again. Read his autobiography, Open Great Sports Book. And I'm assuming that might be a typo, I'm not sure. Was there Adrian McPartland, what's he saying there? My eyesight is not great.
Gordon Bombay had his dreams crushed by a sudden death penalty miss as a youngster and vowed never to
be Mighty
again.
Ducks, of course.
Mighty Ducks. You're thinking as well of Goran Ivanišević when he won at Wimbledon, and the emotion of meeting his dad in the crowd, and no real interest in tennis, but like that was, he was a wild card. It was a complete fluke, and he'd probably been completely written off as a tennis player. Obviously Limerick and Offaly in the hurling, you know, that from my earliest actual sporting memory, it was Cork beating Galway in 90. When 5:15 to 2:21, and Galway were in absolute cruise control, and for a young Galwegian this was heartbreaking. I think it was whatever age I was at the time, and never seen them win All-Ireland until obviously 2 years ago. Limerick then, obviously the same story with them, that awfully comeback meant that their famine went on for so long, and that really was ridiculous. Like Limerick fans were there celebrating prematurely. Offaly fans had left, and I remember there was a Limerick woman beside me at the All-Ireland hurling final last year, and what were they, 9 points up after, and I basically congratulated her, and she said no, we're from Limerick, it doesn't work like that. And I said no, you're grand. And obviously next thing, Joe has a point to level it, and yeah. I was kind of looking at her, and it was the first time ever watching Galway hurlers where I generally ceded a bit of kind of my will to the person beside me, because like I can't really, I just don't want to see this happen to these Limerick fans, because they were so pumped up for it. And this woman beside me, we were having great old crack throughout the game. I was like, I just can't see this go wrong. And I would have felt really sorry for her. Obviously, they were all right in the end. But that was a hell of a comeback as well. We just fell a point short.
That was. I know. I watched that in the press box, actually, that day with Tommy Walsh next to me.
Yeah.
And on the 62nd minute, I said, Tommy, at what point do you start panicking if you're from Galway? And he kind of looked at the clock and he went, I'd start now.
Yeah.
I said, thanks, Tommy. But then the comeback began. He's like, no, they're there. And I remember when Joe was taking that, I just couldn't look at it. I had the head down. And Tommy's like, it's sailing. It's in. No.
Yeah. I was actually right behind that. And I, at no stage, but even beforehand, I didn't think he'd have the legs to score it. And I think Galway had a player, Pádraig Mannion had actually gone to collect the ball, and if he'd passed it to him, but that was for another day. But I remember Galway and Kilkenny as well. This is a Galway team show. I remember Galway and Kilkenny in Turlochmore and in Tullamore rather.
Oh, that was brilliant! Not Turlochmore.
Three goals to come back, Turlochmore. But comebacks are great because it always frustrates me when people leave the ground, like, you know, just to avoid traffic or whatever it is. You know.
Yeah, if you're there, you're there for the whole day.
If you're there, like, life is. You know, we'll all be dead. Why not?
I'm being yelled at by Tommy again to bring this back away from Galway. And he was asking me I think my favourite sporting comeback is Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
I think that's bigger than Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. Lost his title, refused to go in the army. How many years later? And then got the title against George Foreman. I just think, to me, that's the ultimate comeback.
What will John Delaney's comeback be now from whatever happens in the FAI? And I'm genuinely intrigued by this. Where do we go from here with John Delaney? Where will his next role be, I wonder? I know he's still in UEFA, but this will be... He has a hell of a comeback challenge ahead of him, because... It's going to be interesting to see what happens and how he can, I suppose, revive his administrative career.
And that's when I've been yelled in my ear to segue very neatly to what's coming up this morning.
Tommy's giving you a lot of grief. Are you from Galway, by the way?
We have the sports pages coming up. We're going to have Gary Breen in as well. He's going to be talking football with us. It's an amazing weekend as well, especially if you're a Liverpool fan. Obviously, the man of the moment, Tiger Woods, not Joe Canning. Sports news as well, and lots more. We have Roger as well. He's going to be in talking to us later. We're going to have Phil Egan. He's going to be talking about Liverpool. John Duggan is going to be coming in, giving us his take on the Masters weekend. And we have one of actually my old teachers, Dr. Mark Campbell. He taught me when I was studying in UL.
He
taught me.
Taught.
Wound shame. English is my second language. He is coming here. He'll be talking to us shortly after 9 o'clock about the psychology of golf. It's actually really interesting. Even if you've no interest in golf, the psychology is just fascinating. And now it's time for the papers.
I don't have many there, do I?
You don't? No. Maybe we didn't trust you with them. What have I got here? Take a few there.
Take one more.
What have we got? Here is the Times, obviously. Tiger Woods on the front page and the back page. You know it's always a big news story when you're in front and back. And also John Delaney, he may be forced out of the FAI today is the headline there. And Woods, they're calling him a walking miracle.
Yeah, obviously the Times has Tiger at the top. Tiger's comeback for the ages. Klopp blown away by the brilliant Salah. Stunning finish at the bottom there. And if you flick to the back page, interesting article for racing fans. Why introducing new whip rules for jockey is a sensible move, and that's Brian O'Connor, who is an excellent judge of racing and writes very thought-provoking articles. They've just changed the whip rules in Ireland.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, you'd be better to explain that now than most people.
It's an interesting one. They've capped the amount of times a horse can be hit. Now, most people listening to this show probably don't understand. The whip is a misnomer in many respects in racing. It's not a whip. It's basically a piece of whatever it is, a piece of rubber that makes a cracking type noise, but actually doesn't hurt the horse at all. If I whipped you on the hand, it literally doesn't hurt. So you can imagine a horse, like, it doesn't hurt them at all. But the crack noise kind of just, it clicks with their brain just to kind of run a bit faster. It doesn't hurt them at all, basically. So, but it obviously, because it asks them for a bit more energy.
I was just going to say, could you argue that you're still putting them under pressure because they hear that crack and then they're thinking, I must go faster.
Yeah, but it's I suppose the main thing, the whip. You could have raced without a whip, but as a corrective measure in terms of the safety of the rider, primarily, just it balances like particularly errant horses, just kind of keeps them straight when they're going off course. But the Irish authorities have brought in a cap on how many times you can whip a horse at the discretion of the steward. So if a horse is completely acting a maggot, they'll give you a bit of leeway.
Okay.
So I don't think it's a bad thing. It's been described as a bit of a fudge as well, and sometimes the turf club bring in these rules and they don't really they start off well and they, you know, smack a few lads in the hand, but then they kind of just let things go back to normal. But it's probably not a bad thing.
Okay. We also have the Irish Daily Mirror here. And again, the sport is just going to show what a great weekend it was in your sport in front and back pages. It's going to the wire, obviously talking about the Premier League. Tiger Rose, you are done, Delaney. John Delaney is there. And redemption, obviously, Tiger Woods wearing the red T-shirt of a Sunday. You know things are going well.
Well, that's actually quite remarkable because the Star is the same thing. There are three things in the front page: Masterclass, D-Day for Delaney, and no slip-ups for Poole. They're all sport. Now, sport is the great triviality, in fairness. I mean, it ultimately doesn't matter in terms of how life operates, but there you are, anyway. Back page, Delaney could exit today. Cry of the Tiger. Cry of the Tiger, quite nice. And Mo's perfect response. Great to see Salah, in fairness, back to a bit of form and what he was doing last season.
And the Irish Sun, again, we have John Delaney on the front page. Squeaky bum time is the headline there. And the back page, sensational Woods wins fifth Masters. Tiger embraces son 22 years after father. It's a real full circle going there. I'm the daddy. There's
yeah,
the headline.
That's a lovely headline. Obviously, the recollection of meeting his father, which he discussed in that rather weird Butler's Cabin interview type thing, where it was kind of like five extremely boring lads that don't drink, like kind of just talking over tea on a Sunday morning or something. Of course, it's perfectly acceptable not to drink, but they were quite boring. The greatest, this is the Irish Daily Mail. Masterful Tiger wins first major in 11 years. Delaney on the brink. Axe to fall as FAI ready to announce major shake-up, which is interesting because nobody really seems to know what's going to happen there. And yeah, that's the Daily Mail.
And we have the Herald here. We have Magic Moment, which is obviously Mo Salah's magic goal yesterday, which is amazing. Back page, obviously, Tiger Rose. Haha, bit of a pun there, back years. And we also have Mo Magic, FAI grant threat as Delaney nears exit, which is, of course, something people will be very worried about. And an interesting point is that Rory O'Carroll and Dermot Connolly both back playing for clubs in Dublin.
Yeah. Davy Russell actually put up a tweet last night saying he heard a rumour that Tiger Role was going to be ridden by Tiger Woods at the Grand National next year, which would be a great story, really. And knowing Tiger, there's probably nothing stopping him from actually achieving that. This is the Daily Telegraph Sport, the greatest, and one paper that John Delaney can probably buy this morning if he wants to see nothing about himself.
Anything else left there?
I think that's it.
Yeah, Irish
unless
news.
You want the
here we
the,
go.
The Aldi,
Tiger Woods again.
The Aldi brochure here. And
the Aldi.
Tiger roars back and...
Oran McNeil
is sit out the Donegal come in. You know, it'll be interesting. We're obviously coming into the championship soon, but the narrative has definitely switched a bit in terms of... we'll talk a bit about Dublin, but the likes of Donegal will consider themselves in with a fair chance to get into the Super 8s. And once we're into the Super 8s this year, you'd never know. There'll be one team in the Super 8s that has absolutely no chance to win the All-Ireland, maybe two.
Yeah.
But five or six will be there thinking if they can possibly avoid Dublin, because Dublin could lose at the semi-final stage, just depending on how things work out. It might be an interesting year just yet.
Yeah, and we've the Irish Indo as well, should be popping up there on screen. Obviously, again, Tiger Woods, the big shot there. It's a great shot when you can actually see everyone cheering him on.
Not on their phones.
No, not for once, exactly. Yeah, they're actually watching this.
Which is a great thing in Augusta, because they don't allow you to have your phone in, as far as I know. You have to have as far as I know, you can't have your phone on you at all. Right. There's some quite, you know, notionally archaic rules in Augusta. But it's like these things should be encouraged more, where basically you're banned from using your phone, just because it's better for everyone anyway, because it's like a third arm at this stage where you can't function without it. And it's sad watching guys taking, you know, all these photos of lads taking a corner or whatever, just because they can. It's just like, well, you're at a sporting event, like, can you not just watch the game?
Yeah.
And we're all guilty of it, I suppose, but it's definitely something that I thought was quite refreshing in terms of something that was quite archaic, but definitely actually works.
Wimbledon as well is very strict. I've been there a few times. I know it's politely strict. You know, you're very much gently reminded to do this and do that. And like sometimes you feel you can't even sneeze like during a rally or something, the noise, and people are only allowed to move at certain times. And, you know, it's really, really, really respected. Like nobody would think that. Maybe it's a different type of person who maybe goes in there as well. I don't know, that they might be more genteel than we would be. I don't know. But you kind of feel like you'd be afraid to leave your handbag down too loudly or something, you know. But I think it makes a difference, like you said, because people are actually enjoying the moment.
Of course, yeah. And it's just a constant distraction, you know, where you feel you have to tell people you're there. Just enjoy it.
Yeah, well, I think that's... we had the Indo headline up there as well, did we? We did. So we've had all the papers there now. So we just get into a few stories. I suppose the big one really is the FAI and
what's
most
been happening
the papers
there.
Say it's D-Day for Delaney, and that's what you said earlier. We kind of don't know what's going to happen today.
Yeah, it's developed quite I suppose, fast. I just wanted to bring a bigger point here. Journalism is in major kind of flux for the last, 10, 15 years because of, you know, it's hard to imagine life before the internet, but it did happen. And in those days, when I got into journalism, the internet was something that was sort of taken off, but I think it was probably even before the time of text messages, you know, so they seem like simpler times and actually makes me seem quite old.
I feel like asking, what age are you?
Yeah, well, when I was in college, I was the only one in my class who didn't have a mobile phone in first year because I was kind of like reluctant. And then
what
I got
year
one.
Were you in first year?
2000.
You're only a year ahead of me, so I was in 01, yeah.
But anyway, so journalism, I had an aspiration of being, I suppose, I went in there wanting to be a football journalist, whatever, but it was all about the newspaper. And it was great how newspapers were so, you know, dominant in terms of the narrative of the discussion of the time and all that. And then they had to embrace the internet. Some newspapers gave away their content for free. And I think that was quite damaging in the sense of everyone from a generation after me expected their news for free and they just didn't buy newspapers. So newspapers are going to die off in the next few years in Ireland for 100%. And it's going to be difficult. And people don't buy newspapers anymore. I don't buy newspapers as much as I did, but I'd willingly pay subscriptions. And what the Sunday Times have done with the FAI stuff just goes to show the value of proper journalism, because Mark Tighe in the Sunday Times effectively has brought down the FAI structure almost single-handedly. He started the process that brought the Oireachtas Committee into being. And this is journalism at its absolute best, where after years and years and years of not being able to tell this story because of fears of maybe litigation or whatever, they went after a story and they've exposed something extremely rotten, you know, regardless of how much we know. And I don't think we know anywhere near the amount that actually will come out. They've brought down, you know, they will bring down one of the biggest kind of sporting personalities in Ireland, who, in my view, you know, I think the FAI have done a lot of damage to Irish football. So I think this is absolutely marvellous for journalism, what's happened. And what happens as well, as, and you know this as well, because Mark got the ball rolling, there's an absolute fight in for all these journalists who like share their copy at these kind of insipid press days. All of a sudden now they're battling against each other to get the next story and the next break in the story. And that's proper journalism. And we really need that. We need people to pay. We need people to buy subscriptions. We need people to buy newspapers. And it's fantastic what's happened here. And what will happen today is, I understand from reading the papers this morning, and there's some great stuff in it, is that probably John Delaney will be gone. But there's a lot of procrastination. I mean, they met, the board, I believe, met on Saturday. So I don't really know why there's such a big delay. But just from reading the papers, it seems that Daniel MacDonald made the point in the Irish Independent today that there's anger that John Delaney's kind of leaking to, I think, his friend in Kerry.
Yeah, he put a tweet out there as well last night.
We have an FNI statement from Dan, but it's not to do with the position of John Delaney. Instead, a response to Sport Ireland funding concern.
That was last night, yeah.
So in Dan's article today, he makes the point that there's anger among one or two, if not more, board members that it sounds like John Delaney's leaving on his own terms and he's kind of jumping before he's pushed. Because of the message relayed via his friend in Kerry, I think, who was on RT. So that's interesting. And but this doesn't surprise me, Maura, because it's just what happened at the Oireachtas Committee last Wednesday. I struggle to see how this is Mark McCann. Mark McCann, this isn't like, you know, ticking the boxes until you can kind of go out again after a month of sobriety or whatever. This is like the X marks an FAI statement relating to government's 9th since March 16th. It was, if this were a cafe loyalty card, they'd be entitled to a free latte. Very good for Mark McCadden. But it's not surprising, if you are to believe what you believe, that some of the board members are unhappy with John Delaney because of his performance last Wednesday, where he basically absolved himself from talking. And I thought that was really, really poor.
Yeah, but he would argue, and he's absolutely right to argue, that that is his legal right to do so.
He's not absolutely right to it at all. Well, he had legal advice with regard to something. That was the greatest cop-out. I mean, legal advice with regard to...
You can say it's a cop-out, yeah, but he will argue very vociferously that it is legal advice.
He had legal advice with regard to the 100 grand loan, which is one thing. He could easily... He answered questions when he wanted to in the second half of the show. So he basically... the legal advice was a cop-out for other things he didn't want to answer. And there's no way he couldn't have answered other questions. And it was very, very hard for some of the the other members to answer questions that really should have been answered by him. And they were made to look like idiots. And I think they were probably quite angry coming out of it. And I'd love to be a fly in the wall as to the conversations they're having with them. But these are revolutionary days for Irish football. Philip Quinn has a very interesting article in the Mail about what needs to happen. John Byrne, who was involved and seemingly had a falling out with Delaney on the board a few years ago, he's interviewed, I think, by Paul Lennon in The Star about what needs to happen. But we need a complete root and branch change. We need basically everyone on the board to leave and have a bit of dignity, and for once in this country have a bit of accountability and say, I was accountable partly for this. I was on a board that was dysfunctional. I probably was on a board that didn't look after Irish football properly, and for the best of Irish football now, I will step down and let somebody else come involved, because it's needed. The League of Ireland has been neglected in a disgraceful manner, and it's thrived to some extent within itself. It's gotten very little help from the FAI. We've a
nearly argued they've thrived in spite of,
yeah. I mean, speaking to the League of Ireland, some League of Ireland, I've spoken to Gary Rogers, who's part of the PFAI statement. There's huge anger there. Huge anger. There was an article in the Business Post yesterday, and somebody was quoted, unnamed, who basically said, we've no idea how much of the SSE electricity money goes into the League of Ireland. We don't know how much actual money goes in terms of sponsorship to the League of Ireland. So there are affiliation fees for the likes of Finn Harps, who are struggling. 300 people at the game the other night. They have to pay the guts of 20 grand in licensing fees for the year. They're not going to get any prize money. So how are they functioning without TV money or prize money? And then you've a guy reputedly, anyway, spending $4,000 on his credit card in 6 months. I mean...
Well, interesting that you do mention League of Ireland. And I know the thing with John Delaney is we are talking a bit in a vacuum at the moment because there'll be more stuff happening today. So I'm very aware that, you know, we're talking, we don't really know what we're talking about.
Yeah, but John Delaney is more than entitled to tell us what's wrong with anything,
yes,
that was being in the papers the last few days.
What we do know is that League of Ireland is happening again tonight. And that is a good, you know... There's good stories to be told, and maybe this might be the situation now. This broom is coming in, let's clean things out, and we can actually talk about football that's actually happening,
well,
and stuff.
I was at Shamrock Rovers Waterford the other night. Jack Byrne was playing. Jack Byrne, who was once, you know, I suppose the love child in some respects of the Manchester City guys who were there and loved him. Now things have maybe not happened for him, but he's back in Ireland, he's enjoying his football. Shamrock Rovers have gotten to where they are because they've developed a youth structure and they've gotten some European prize money over the last few years, and the game the other night was exceptionally enjoyable. But they didn't do that because of help from above, in my view. They did it because they looked at the potential of Shamrock Rovers on the premise that we could make money from selling players like Bazuna and Graham Burke, and we could make money from Europe. And that's how they're basically being funded. Not from League of Ireland prize money, because it effectively doesn't exist. But anyway, what happened the other night was quite astonishing. Shamrock Rovers have gone so far ahead of Dundalk now, 13 points, albeit with two games more played, that Dundalk are playing Bohemians tonight. Bows are second. Dundalk absolutely have to win this game tonight. Big, big pressure on Vinnie Perth and his management team, because if they don't win tonight, I think it's basically game over.
Is it as simple as just new management still trying to bed in Dundalk, or is there something deeper going on?
I don't know if there's anything deeper going on, Maura. I mean, what happened was they lost three of their main midfielders in the first few weeks of the year. You can't legislate for that. Despite the cover that they've had, that's hard to deal with. But they were very, very poor by all accounts in Sligo the other night. I talked to Arthur O'Dea, the Sligo Rovers fan, in the office earlier, and he was just saying that the vibe was how well Sligo played down there, but Dundalk were quite poor, and they were quite poor against Pats, and it's difficult for Vinnie because it's very hard to replace Stephen Kenny.
Yeah,
you know, it's very, very difficult. But if you're in the Dundalk region tonight, I'll definitely get along for the game, because, you know, we talk about sport being the triviality that it is, but sport is basically the pressure cooker in front of your eyes, and there's a lot of pressure on that Dundalk management team tonight. Whereas Bows, who are effectively part-time, have conceded 3 goals this season and at the moment have been the biggest challenger to Shamrock Rovers. Shamrock Rovers have a night off now, so it's a fascinating night. I'm going to go to Pats and Derry in Inchicore. Derry have had a great season, great crowds at the Brandywell, and all of this happened, arguably, I would argue, because of the talent within the league at grassroots, the talent within the coaching, and the hunger of fans like Jonathan O'Brien, who was thrown out of Turner's Cross on Friday night to keep the show on the road.
It's interesting when you talk about Dundalk, and we know the financial aspect of the League of Ireland, how it's just not good, but they'd be the only ones possibly with a little bit of money, and it just goes to show sometimes that talent, for a while anyway, at least in the short term, can sometimes trump those with the cash.
It's all down to, like, they got 6 or 7 million from UEFA in 2016. That sort of money is completely unheard of in the League of Ireland. Now, the reason League of Ireland clubs are doing okay at the moment is mainly because of UEFA prize money. Mm. And because of the fact these very, very talented players who want to play in Ireland accept wages that are pretty bang average for any of us living in Dublin, for argument's sake. Like, lots of League of Ireland players are playing, they've short careers, but they're earning wages that are decidedly modest. Mm. And these lads are not getting extremely rich, and they can't get rich in a league where there is no funding, basically. A professional sport, our most popular sport in the country, in one of the richest countries in the world in which to live, has no prize money, and we've accepted that as being okay, and this has to stop. The reason that we've done okay is because of the talent of the players and an ability from the coaches to say that we want you to play football and entertain people, and I think the league's in a great place in terms of the quality, and anyone who goes to see Pats and Derry tonight will come away and say, actually, that was my first League of Ireland experience, and despite the fact that they've been neglected from above, I actually really enjoyed it. And it's in a good place at the moment. It really is. Galway United, our local club, certainly isn't. But the League of Ireland's in a good place.
Another thing that's in a good place, people would say, is the Dublin football club scene. We saw Rory O'Carroll back. He was playing for Kilmacud over the weekend. Dermot Connolly back as well, playing in defence, interestingly enough. And Bernard Brogan as well. He also got 1-6. So it's been a really interesting weekend in the Dublin Club Championship. It might be giving Jim Gavin's new options.
New options, old options.
Yeah.
German's an interesting one because I think I've spoken to maybe a couple of people involved, and the notion was that he wouldn't come back. But there's a lot to be said for it, isn't there? You know, if Dublin. The one thing about Dublin this year is you can look at it as a positive that they've lost three league games, in that there's a lot of, like, this talk of the invincible five in a row now. There's probably a part of Jim Gavin who's kind of happy that there's a lot more belief that Dublin are beatable, and there's not as much talk about this invincibility and the fact that it's a five in a row. So that's one thing. But there is also the fact that he's said things post-game that he didn't really say before, where he kind of said this wasn't good enough from the players, particularly that was the Tyrone game. So bringing in the likes of Jeremy Connolly...
If he brings him in, we might not.
I'm not sure at all. No. I genuinely don't know. It might be a complete non-runner, but it would give them maybe a little bit of a lift, because there probably is a little bit of soul searching going on within that Dublin team. To be beaten by Tyrone and Croke Park in particular was quite galling. You know, the way games they lost, you could say things went against them, particularly in Kerry. But I don't know. Jeremy Connolly, I'm not sure how he played the other night or whatever, but the talent is there. And Dublin have a few creaks in their team where you could say that there have a few vulnerabilities, and the likes of Jeremy coming in psychologically, why not?
And you could argue as well, having Rory O'Carroll coming in, maybe, because if there's one place where the Dubs are vulnerable, it's that high ball coming in.
100%.
The likes of him might be very, very...
But it was something that it was actually a fella from Galway, I remember, making the point to me last year. This is one Dublin deficiency that just hasn't been targeted. Tyrone targeted in the All-Ireland final with a couple of Hail Marys, and he ended up getting a goal out of it. But it was kind of, the game was up at that stage. Galway scored a goal against them from the high ball. And it's very, very hard to defend against a high ball in the box. So it's kind of like, Gaelic football is evolving such that it's so, and Kevin Walsh would certainly attest to this, it's all about possession, possession, possession. But sometimes putting a high ball into the box can result in the bounty of a goal. And goals are so, you know, prized in Gaelic football now that it's definitely the big thing, I think, that they will target Dublin and other teams this year.
Well, before we go, start talking about Galway again, how great it is. We're talking football next here on OTV AM. We've got Gary Breen, First Hears coming up, but first here's Nathan Murphy and Kevin Kilbane calling that Salah wonder goal yesterday.
He knows what it means. Salah takes the shot. Mo Salah with one of the goals of the season. 25 yards out, smashes a shot into the top corner of the net, and Liverpool are going back on top of the Premier League, and Mo Salah is back to his very, very best. It's Liverpool 2, Chelsea 0. Mo Salah, pick it out.
What a goal. Unbelievable.
Yeah, well, even Kev was excited.
Even Kev. Which just goes to show how excited he was. Gary Breen, I know we have you here. Even if you never saw football in your life, you'd have to appreciate that Mo Salah goal.
It was amazing. It really was. And what a moment to get it. The very fact that they'd got the first goal just to settle the nerves. And then the emotion after a wonder strike like that. We can hear it from the guys in commentary, but the atmosphere at the stadium looked immense.
It's they're back on top now. It's the fairy tale ending, really, if they manage to keep it up. But I suppose the other problem is they have that other piranha in the water, Man City, that's also circling around.
Yeah, exactly. But when you listen to the Liverpool players now, I've just heard the reports of Salah, they believe it. It's not a case of they're hoping that it's going to happen. They genuinely believe that if they win all their games, City will drop points. And you have to look at City, the very fact that they've got such tough games over the next, over a 7-day period, Tottenham twice, then United. And then a few days after that, they go away to Burnley, who are resurgent now under Sean Dyche. So it looks like City have it all to do. I was at the City game yesterday and everyone had identified that that's a tough place to go, Selhurst Park. But the reality was, Palace have only won 4 games at home all season. So you were thinking, well, listen, City going to flex their muscle, so their composure, their character. And they did. They absolutely controlled the game from start to finish. It was only when they allowed a poor free kick to go in that suddenly there was a bit of nerves with 5 or 6 minutes to go. But then he went up the other end and got that third goal. So, listen, they're a fantastic team and it's been an incredible title race.
It's not so much maybe a worry about Liverpool now, considering the way they played yesterday and their running isn't too bad. But do you see enough in Manchester United and maybe Spurs without Kane to do the needful? Because obviously Liverpool are still reliant on that. And Man United, I don't know at the moment, would you have much faith in them beating Man City or even getting a draw?
Well, certainly in the Manchester derby, I'd back City heavily. I think they're far superior to United. I know United had that renaissance under Solskjaer, but they seem like they've reverted to type. They don't look like players capable of getting United back to where they want to be. I think Harry Kane, everyone initially thinks that that's going to really affect Tottenham. I don't think it will have that much of a bearing on it, to be perfectly honest. I think Moura and Son give them real pace and energy running in behind. And that's the way you can hurt this City defence. The problem is you don't get enough of the ball. Having said that, Tottenham are good. They can control possession, as they proved in the first leg of the Champions League quarterfinal. So City really do have it all to do.
It's I know we say they're difficult games, and on paper they would be for any other team, but this is City, so they're probably not that hard for them. That'd be my thinking. So that's, if you were there as a Liverpool fan, you'd still be worried because it's City of all teams.
Yeah, you're right. In terms of their consistency, they've been incredible. And even Guardiola said it yesterday, 183 points over the course of these 2 seasons. That's averaging 2.6 a game. So they know how to get the business done. And really, one of the most noticeable things yesterday was Kevin De Bruyne. He comes back into the team. It was a shock, really, didn't play in that first leg against Spurs. But the very fact he's been out injured, he'll be coming to this business end of the season fresh. And the quality he showed yesterday was absolutely incredible. He was making passes that Guardiola said that a lot of other players don't even see, and he's executing them. There was one particular pass that he played it. He'd done a reverse pass, completely fooled everyone, even Aguero. Had he continued his run, he was in on goal, and it was sensational. And that's the level that he's playing at. So coupled with that, with Sterling, who's added goals to his game, we've said so often as a young player that he lacks that composure, that finishing ability. Well, he's got it in abundance now. So they do look like they have those match winners throughout that team.
Just on Raheem Sterling, you know, some kind of parallel with Tiger Woods here in the sense of Tiger Woods with the comeback. Sterling looked to me like a player that you just couldn't coach him to actually do the proper thing in front of goal, Gary, and that he, you know, for all the talent he had, he always just struck me as kind of just maybe just lacked that instinct or maybe game intelligence in front of goal. But you got to, like, De Bruyne's pass, obviously, for his first goal was absolutely outrageous and all that. But Sterling's finishing the season and the quality of coaching, and to advertise the quality of coaching, his the change in his game, I think, is quite amazing.
Well, listen, this doesn't get enough chat about this for me in terms of what Guardiola does. Everyone identifies this. He's had brilliant players. But it's what he does on a training field. He improves them. And there's so many of that City squad who've gone to a complete another level. But you're right to highlight Sterling. He missed what would be a sitter compared to what he's had this season, about 5 or 10 minutes before that first goal. But when that through ball was played, he had a lot of time. He was obviously going to run away from the fullback. He was obviously going to beat the centre half. So he had a lot of time to think about it. And it was those situations, Johnny, you're right, that he used to struggle in. But the composure as he went through, when we were doing the commentary, we didn't feel it would be anything other than a goal. And he finished it brilliantly. That second one was a lovely side foot finish as well, left footed, which is not his strength. But I do believe he has gone to another level. This guy is not even 25 yet. And to think of what he's achieved as a young player, initially coming up from London, going to Liverpool and all this, the pressure associated with that big money move, then having the strength of character to say, listen, I'm not going to achieve what I want at Liverpool. I want to go and win titles. He goes to City. And then to make this racism such a topical thing now to take on the press and the way he's done it. He's an iconic player and he's an iconic footballer. He's an iconic young man. He's a credit to his family and to his football club.
I couldn't agree more there. Like I spoke about the media and the value of the media, you know, a couple of minutes ago, but the media has been nothing short of disgraceful in the way they've treated...
Oh, they've been racist.
Absolutely disgraceful. And the manner that he has then, on the flip side, dealt with racism, with something with the help of the media to an extent to get that message across, couldn't agree more with Gary. He's an absolute icon for what he's done, and for all the vilification, to have the bravery and just to say, listen, I'm going to get on with it, I'm going to score goals and take it like that.
And also say, I'm also going to take on the racists, which is, I think is really brave, because that's hard to do, because you forget, he's really young.
He's really young.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, it's again, we're talking about sport as a triviality, but he's gone beyond that, Gary, in the sense of being proud of, obviously, you know, his race and being proud of his ability on the pitch and just being proud of who he is.
Well, what's so incredible about him more than anything is that he's done it while he's so relevant, that he's such an important player. Now, the generation that I played with, the top players, your Sol Campbells, after they've stopped playing, they then come out and say things like, well, if I wasn't black, I would have been England captain and things like that. And they stopped them. And my frustration today was, why didn't you say it when you had a real voice, when it mattered, when you could influence it, when you're in the height of your career? He's done it now. I think there was a lack of bravery to do it because it could have a negative effect on your career, but he was having none of it. For a young man to have that maturity, that strength of character, I've got nothing for admiration for him. I think he's an absolute credit to football in general.
It's actually a great week for football because we've got Champions League again coming up over the next two nights. And again, we've got City and Liverpool both in action. How do you think it's going to pan out?
Well, I think Liverpool's result makes them feel comfortable. I don't think they can be complacent, but I think that they'll go through. Certainly City have got a tough job now. Pep Guardiola said that losing 1-0 is a better result than 0-0. I found that difficult to understand, but I think his point is that they know what they have to do now. They have to really go after Spurs. I think they will do. I think they'll have more control possession. But again, Lucas Moura gets a hat-trick for Tottenham at the weekend. Son looks a different player when he's expected to lead the line and Harry Kane's not there. So they have some real dangers. I think there's going to be an absolute classic Champions League encounter.
We have, so Tuesday we've Barcelona against United and Juventus against Ajax. Then Wednesday, Porto and obviously Liverpool are 2-0 up going over there and Man City down a goal against Spurs. So I don't understand why more people aren't saying, could Liverpool do the double?
Well, listen, they could do. I think only Porto said that they were happy to get Liverpool in that quarterfinal draw. I think everyone else would be delighted to avoid them. And I think it'll be a case that whoever they go up against now, Liverpool can open any team up. They proved that even a team as gifted as Manchester City, they put them to the sword last year in the Champions League. They could do it to any one of those remaining teams. And they'll believe that they can add that Premier League title. Everyone's talking about now, what's the obsession for Liverpool? It is mainly that Premier League title. But they have a very real, genuine chance of actually winning the Champions League also.
Do you think, like, again, I find it quite weird, like, people say, then talk about Liverpool, they're like, oh, Champions League is a distraction, they want the Premier League.
Yeah.
I don't think they mind either way, would they?
No, I get the feeling that the Champions League this year, it sounds absolutely bizarre, but, like, if you offered any Liverpool fan the league now, they literally would say, we don't give a damn about the Champions League. And I mean that. It's a bit like Galway Hurlers and Mayo Footballers. It's just been so long that the agony is just like, they just want to win the league, get it out of the way. They've won the Champions League already. I know they obviously went very close last year, but if you offered Liverpool fans the Champions League now but didn't win the league, I don't think most of them would take that.
What do you think, Gary?
And the flip side of that is, I think if you offered the City supporters the Champions League, would they sacrifice the Premier League?
Absolutely.
I think they probably would.
But absolutely.
But football doesn't work like that, does it? You can't pick and choose.
I do think, though, with Liverpool, I'd still prefer to be in Man City's shoes because it's just they control their destiny. I know they haven't an easy run in, but, like, Gary, if you're a player, you know, would you not prefer to be in the Man City team now? You have De Bruyne back, and as you say, De Bruyne is basically like a new signing. To me, he's the best player in the world, apart from Messi probably, but he's the best player in the world on his game, best player in the Premier League anyway. He's like a new player. You go into these games now, you're looking at De Bruyne, the way he's playing, you're like, I'd prefer to be in the Man City team to basically be able to say, we can decide this ourselves by just winning all our games, as opposed to Liverpool, who are reliant on them slipping up.
Yeah, listen, you always want to be in control of your own destiny. The only problem you have is that congestion of games. Mm. That Liverpool have a nice breather between each one of them, so you expect them to see everyone through. And I know everyone would argue the case, well, listen, they've assembled a squad, City, to cope with these demands. They've got such strength in depth. But even the likes of Aguero looked looked tired yesterday, and you're hoping now that he can just get that re-energy. I'll counter that by saying, as you rightly said, De Bruyne's back, Mendy's back, he gives him real energy. Sane hasn't played as many games as you would expect, certainly since they lost to Newcastle, so he's full of energy as well. So it's such a difficult one to call, it really is.
Oh, that's a great place to leave it. Gary Breen, thank you very much for your time this morning. Chat again soon. Johnny, more importantly, talking about football, forget about football, let's talk about Galway. I'm getting tweets in here.
Yeah,
I have
yeah.
one saying, being in college there, spending the day in the Roisin Dhuibh and heading in to the snack box for cheese, curry and chips. The snack box is no longer there. And also, tell Tommy he's a bollocks next time he shouts in your ear.
Absolutely. you know, Tommy's disgraced himself this morning. He may be a nice enough lad, but I mean, there's never a bad time just to talk about nothing but Galway.
Were you ever in the snack box? I don't remember the snack box. Maybe I'm too young.
No, I've been the Roisin Dhuibh, which in
many
fairness is one of the iconic parts of Galway. The one thing you would say about Galway, would it never not put you in good form when you arrive in the city and you go to O'Connell's or somewhere like that, or you just, it's just an extremely friendly place full of great people.
I love when it's raining and you're miserable.
Yeah, it generally is.
And you go down to Freeney's and you sit in the back by the fire and then you see somebody you know. And do you remember Nora around town? She died there a few months ago, Nora Collins. She used to walk by and that kind of stuff. I'm going to get killed now as I'm talking about Galway.
We would welcome all your Galway stories at Off the Ball AM this morning.
Yeah, OTB AM, forget about football, forget about golf, just send us your Galway stories, 53106. We have actually video reaction here now as well, obviously, because the big story is Tiger Woods. We're talking him next here on OTB AM, and here's the moment he won the Masters yesterday.
Many doubted we'd ever see it.
Remarkable story.
But here it is. The return to glory.
22 years on from the first green jacket comes the fifth. It's major number 15 for Tiger Woods.
Yeah, it went on as well. It went on for some time. I was obviously a human level. You're watching it, and he just didn't look like a guy who was going to let this slip because he was everything was so perfect. He'd won obviously bad shots when he knew he could afford one dodgy shot on the 18th. But
Joe Malloy as well is in. I think he's. Have you gone to bed at all, Joe?
I'm going soon, I swear.
It's just, I'd say you were so excited last night, nothing was going to send you into the cot.
Well, not just me, I mean everyone. It seems like a global story, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is a great story. Like, it's a great story of redemption, but as I always do try to point out, like, I think the reason people love the story of redemption is the fact that he was very, very flawed and he did some really bad things. I just think it's always really important just to remember that as well. You know, he's not a perfect human being, and maybe that's why the outpouring of emotion was there.
I would imagine he is still very flawed. You know, he was pictured a couple of weeks ago arm in arm with Donald Trump. You know, in many respects, Tiger Woods is one of the great disappointments off the course of any icon. He's right up there in terms of disappointments as well. Like, he's incredibly flawed. And we did an interview with Armin Kettyman, who wrote a brilliant book about him in the last year, you know. And in some respects, what is more horrible about Woods in that book is not the scandal and the more salacious headline-grabbing stuff. It's just his general way with people. Is shockingly, shockingly rude on a routine level, or was anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of person he is now. And there are certainly genuine hints that he has softened and mellowed and gained a sense of perspective. And maybe being a father does that. And maybe essentially spending 2 to 3 years lying on your back, unable to move, looking at how you've messed up your life in many respects, maybe that gives you a pretty good sense of perspective as well. So there are hints that he's a softer, more refined human being, but certainly for the bulk of his career, he was rude, you know. I can give you one story from that book which just illustrates it as an example of what I'm talking about. It's so small, but it's indicative of an attitude. And it was at Augusta. He stayed in the same house for years and years and years. Mark O'Meara rented it. Tiger was friendly with O'Meara. And the year O'Meara won the Masters, they were all very excited. They ran back to the house to get changed because they wanted to go back out to Augusta for the party, you know. And Mark O'Meara's wife was next door. They'd gotten to know the neighbours the O'Meara's had around the area. And she was inside next door having a glass of champagne. Mark was getting changed upstairs in the rented house. He said to Tiger, go next door, will you, and just check what time we have to leave at. And Woods went next door and he asked him and his wife, you know, Mark wants to know what time we have to leave. Grand. And there was a woman there who stood up and said, Tiger, hi. It's actually lovely to meet you. It's my house that you guys have been staying in all these years. And Tiger looked over at her, said nothing in front of a lot of people, looked back at Mark Amir's wife and said, I'm going to wait next door. Or words to that effect. And the woman is like...
But he's a weirdo, Joe, in many ways, isn't he? I mean, if you look at his background and his upbringing, it's probably not surprising that he's a little bit different.
I think that's... like, everybody's a product of their environment in so many respects, you know?
You had a great upbringing, didn't you? Look at him now.
Look at me now.
Look at him there, so genial and smiley first thing of the morning. You know, that's a sign of real good rearing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, actually, speaking of journalism, that ESPN piece that I referenced, if nobody's read it, it might take you about an hour. I think you probably know the piece I'm talking about. Just his fascination with the army and with all that like regimental upbringing that he had and his relationship with his father.
Life of Tiger, was it?
Really interesting. Yeah, it's really fascinating, Joe, and I guess he's just a very flawed human being.
He is, and you know, part of it's our fault as well, because why do we trust such fame and money and fortune in somebody who can hit a little white golf ball around a big field? You know, even the most well-adjusted person, I think, would have struggled with becoming an icon at the age of 21.
I remember actually that interview you were talking about there, Joe. I was actually driving in the car coming up from Limerick. I was actually listening to you speak to that author. And I don't like Tiger Woods. I'll say that out. I admire what he's achieved. But after listening to that interview, I really didn't like him. He just came across like such a horrible person.
Now, the one thing I would say to that, and I said it to the author on the night, I said the one problem with that book is that there was virtually no positive testimony from anybody about Woods. Now, nobody is all bad. And I think in Woods' defense, that book, he could argue, was just hatchet jobs too strong because it was well-researched and he spoke to lots of good people. But there was nothing good. Like, I don't believe that Woods is just a thoroughly bad person. I said flawed, you know, and he certainly is flawed. But we never saw any of the good stuff. And he does have friends and he does have people who love him. And he does seem to have a great relationship with his children. So, you know, look, and like on the... multiple affairs, you know, he was a
no laughing matter, Joe.
He was a lost person. Yeah. Like that was when you read about what he was doing, it was beyond grim. That was a destroyed soul. He was lost. His life was out of control. Like he wasn't happy. These were not fun encounters by the sounds of things. So, you know, it's a complicated picture. It's one of the reasons he's fascinating.
Can I just bring you up that you made the point about Donald Trump there? And before you came on, Gary Breen was extolling what, you know, Raheem Sterling has done in terms of racism and that. And Tiger Woods is in a position where he could have a major say in this kind of, you know, not for want of a better word, debate. Yes, he's friendly with the racist that is Donald Trump.
Yeah, I know. It's difficult to square in many respects because you wouldn't think he needs to be. It's another, if you were to build the case against Tiger Woods, it's certainly another point you could put into the argument. I do feel like this conversation's gone off an incredibly negative light considering what's just happened.
We've 99% of happiness, so it's good to get a different voice.
It's good to actually discuss the man that he is and the fact that he's had this massive redemptive...
I'm 99% happy. I don't want to come on here and just hatchet job him either, you know, because what he has done is extraordinary. Yes, he's flawed in so many ways.
But that's why it's such a great story, is because he is flawed and because he gives us something to talk about. He's not vanilla. He's not just there. We actually have stuff to talk about. And for so long, this was kept hidden. And it's just, I don't like the man, but he's an interesting man. But, I mean, to go away from the personality and look at the golf as such, it must be really exciting as a golf fan to see somebody who everybody would have thought, that's it, he's gone, washed up. And all of a sudden he's back, even despite all his flaws, with a huge sprinkling of star power.
Well, you see, that is why it's an amazing story. It's because what he's done here is a contender for the greatest sporting comeback of all time. Genuinely. I mean, I can't think of a more improbable comeback that I've seen in my lifetime. People have mentioned Ben Hogan a good few times. And people have mentioned Niki Lauda. Now, you know, I was saying to Mick Foley at the Sunday Times last night, if you separate their proximity to death, which I admit is a factor, you know, Hogan in a car crash and destroyed his his bones and Niki Lauda's face, obviously, and other injuries, their recoveries were more straightforward. Ben Hogan was winning a US Open, admittedly in pain, but within a year he was winning the US Open. He was at the peak of his powers. Bones mend. It wasn't straightforward. I'm not saying that. It was remarkable, and you hate to talk down other great achievements. But he was winning the US Open within a year. Niki Lauda, how he got back in a car again, I don't know. It's one of the great displays of nerve any of us will ever see in sport. But Woods was destroyed. He had three back surgeries in the space of 19 months. He had four knee surgeries around that period as well, a little bit before. But three back surgeries in 19 months. They had given up. The spinal fusion, which he ultimately had, his fourth surgery, was as much about quality of life as it was about playing golf again. He just wanted to be able to kick a football around with his daughter and play with his children. He was at a Champions dinner in 2017. And he said to, it was either Faldo or Jack Nicklaus. I've seen various reports, maybe both of them. But he said to them, I'm done. Like, I'm wrapping this thing up. It's just not meant to be. It's over. And he went for the spinal fusion. He flew to London the next day. He had the surgery. And he also had the chipping yips. I mean, there's one thing physically, he was ruined. I mean, ruined. He couldn't get out of a chair. He couldn't walk. But then on his many, many comebacks, on occasion, he had the chipping yips. There are stories of the players in the locker room watching Woods on the day where he couldn't chip, where it was duff chip after duff chip. And they turned off the television in the clubhouse. One, because no pro wants to be anywhere near a duff, and just having it in your consciousness is almost a taboo. But two, because they thought it was sad that Tiger Woods was reduced to the chipping yips and under the full glare of the world. So he had to rebuild his entire game from scratch. So most players, if they get the chipping yips, you just don't come back from it because the scar tissue is there. It's hard to forget the chipping yips when you're at Augusta and you've got to chip on 18 or you've got to do something under pressure. So he rebuilt his entire game with these physical limitations. Plus, the field of 2019 destroys the field of 2002 when Woods was in his pomp. So much deeper, so much more talent. Players can hit the ball so much further. And Woods is 43 years of age. And yesterday he beat Brooks Koepka, who's won three majors in the last 16 months, and Molinari, the foreign player in the world, the Open champion, the two best players in the world at the moment, arguably in major terms. He beat them on a Sunday with, I mean, the way he played the course was just phenomenal. But you put all that together, and there's been comeback after comeback. Like, Woods has just done so many interviews from a car park as he gets into his car, hobbles into his car after withdrawing from a tournament, saying, oh, look, I don't know. I'm going to see what happens. It's just, I can't turn, you know. When you add all that up and you consider he's 43 and you consider he hasn't won a major in 11 years, I just don't think I can't imagine genuinely ever seeing a more unlikely or wonderful comeback. And his emotions on 18 were just of a different person, you know. And we've talked about the flaws, but you saw someone there, I think, humbled by the scandal. I think humbled by how destroyed his body was. He had the perspective of a father. The emotion with his children is just, I mean, Woods kept that off limits. You know, don't show people you're a human being. Don't, like, we are just, whew, this is business. Get in the clubhouse. But it was like an explosion of relief and ecstasy and disbelief. And, you know, it was amazing on Saturday when he finished his round and he walked to the clubhouse and the entire gallery had lined the route back to the clubhouse. And Woods, back in the day, would have 1,000-yard stare, all business. I'm not even going to acknowledge it. He was, like, beaming the whole way back. It was like a mini victory tour. And honestly, one of my interpretations of that is when he was 21, 22, he was inevitably a bit of a brat and took all the adulation for granted. Like, if I'm Tiger Woods, of course, yeah, get away from me, Joe Public. Whereas almost when you go through what he's gone through away from the course and when you do some of the things he has done, and people still accommodate that and accept that and overlook some of that and give you a second chance, I think he looks around and he values the love. I think he feels love. I think he's looking at this saying, this is actually miraculous in so many fronts, including the fact that you guys, even though you know what I've done, even though everyone knows it's the most horrible Open scandal, you're behind me and you're hoping I do this. And you add all that in and it's layer upon layer of complexity and emotion and improbability. So
Do you think he's finally let the wall down, that people we now might be seeing? I'm not even saying the real Tiger Woods, because I think the Tiger Woods may have changed from that Tiger Woods we've read about in the book, and the guy in his 20s who was just so rude to people, whereas maybe through therapy and all the psychological work he's had to do, and the fact that he's been so humbled just by physical injury. And quite rightly, you said he wasn't near death's door, but, you know, it could have gone that way, especially with the painkillers and things like that. It could be a very, very slippery slope. So maybe he's really had to learn the hard way. But has he learnt?
I don't know. That's the interesting question. I don't know. You would like to think so. Are we seeing all of Tiger? We're seeing 15% maybe of Tiger, which is a lot more than we used to. You would hope so. It would be something miraculous if he was unchanged completely, given everything he's gone through. But none of us know, you know, that is the intriguing thing. And maybe there'll be another book in 10 years and you'll get the truth. But he looks to have, like, he really does look to have mellowed and softened. I'd be very surprised if he's exactly the same person. But as to what he's like day to day, 90% of the time, we can't be quite sure. So I don't want to come on here and say, you know, it's a complete redemption and he's a changed person as well, because that would be too convenient. But certainly what he's done in golfing terms is the ultimate redemption.
But, like, even in human terms, when you look back, we're not the same people we were at 22, and our lives were nowhere near as interesting as Tiger Woods.
Yeah, I mean, if Johnny Ward was the same person he was at 22, Lord knows.
You've been the Roisin Dove dancing away.
I think it's actually sad to say I really haven't changed much at all, and that is my failure.
Johnny Ward's the exception that proves the rule. Some people can just keep on. Can I just briefly, because I know you're probably going to wrap up, if people didn't see the golf yesterday, it was amazingly exciting. And there were various, like, I mean, at one stage there was a 5-way tie for the lead, so he wasn't given this tournament, even though Molinari made those mistakes. There were lots of striking aspects of his play, but above everything, if you want to just watch this tournament in 2 minutes, you could just watch the 12th hole, which is that famous par 3 over water, where of the two front groups, the two leading groups of three, four players went into the water. They took on the pin. Molinari, like the guy who never makes mistakes, Molinari took on the pin. Brooks Koepka, before that, had a double bogey. He went into the water. And Woods, using all of his experience, and he did it a few times across the front nine, where there were just, I mean, Augusta's so clever in so many ways. There were just pins that you can't go near. You just don't take on. And he saw them a mile away. He knew the spots, knew where not to go. And on 12, Peter Allis on commentary was saying, you know, they've always said on 12, just split the bunker. It doesn't matter where you are in the tournament. It doesn't matter where the pin is. Go over that middle bunker. And Molinari went right. He tried to go at the pin a bit. Koepka tried to go at the pin. Fina tried to go at the pin. They seemed to have clean enough shots. But the gusts of wind, the magic that happens there, they ended up in the water. And Woods, just steely, surgical, didn't even look at the pin, just ignored it and on the green. And that changed the whole momentum of the tournament. And look, throughout, some of his iron play was exceptional. He found more fairways than he has in a long time. And people said he couldn't putt, you know, that had gone and that Mother Time had taken that from him. And he's not what he was, but he's not what he was in any respect. And he still put it incredibly well under pressure. His lag putt on nine was extraordinary. So surgically, he took the course apart and was about as comfortable as you could hope to be on an Augusta Sunday. And it was just down to experience. And now, like, it was a really remarkable display. And we've got three majors in the next 3 months, including a Portrush. If you're a golf fan, you really have to try and get up to see this guy at Portrush. So
we've got your kids coming up on screen there as well, Joe. I don't know if you can see them. We've got Leo DiCaprio giving a good clap as well. And all Joe's emotions on Joe's timeline are popping up there. Oh, there's Oprah. Yeah. Oh, God, were you feeling totes most, Joe, at the end of that yesterday afternoon?
And, you know, when he's there with his family and he's behaving in a way I've never seen him behave, it actually hinted at someone who has gone through a lot. That's why I felt, you know, if I felt something, it's not that I was looking at him saying, this guy's just a great guy. You know, I'm just glad he's won. He's just a solid, great, sweet guy. It wasn't that. It was, look at the outburst. He has gone through some really bad times.
Joe's going to get emotional here himself. I know. Joe's going to break down here.
I'm going to let Joe go now. You can put on his Masters onesie, go back into your Tiger Woods duvet and just get yourself some sleep, because you have a big week coming up now of talking about this.
just to reassure people, tonight is not going to be 7 to 10 p.m. of Tiger Woods.
I don't know about that.
No, we won't.
I think out of all of JP's best intentions, that may still happen. Joe Malloy, go back to bed. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Bye.
And we've got Joe gone, and Phil Egan joins us with the headlines.
Bring
good morning.
Bring us back down to earth.
Yeah, these, you know, I'm in a Galway sandwich here. You know,
you are.
That's what a sandwich.
Yeah. That's up there with Ross Geller's Thanksgiving sandwich.
I definitely wouldn't rob it. Yeah, we'll start with Tiger Woods, obviously. Some are calling it the greatest sporting comeback. And on the emotion side of things, I think Jim Nance in the butler's cabin, he was definitely trying to get tears out of Tiger. He threw a question at him about his family, and you could tell he was thinking, you know, if I can get Tiger to cry here now, this would be unbelievable.
I think he referenced his dad, didn't he? And the difference in...
But they showed the clip of 97 when he embraced his dad, and I think... I was thinking, okay, if he does, he's going to cry now. This is going to be the moment. Didn't quite happen.
No.
But
do you remember the Simpsons episode where Homer goes into space and basically, like, the premise of the show is how boring these space launches are, and your man is like, it's a lovely day for a launch here alive at Cape Canaveral. It was like that. They were so boring. I was just like he's after winning. Like, this is one of the greatest. And it's like, well, Tiger, that was quite a show you put on today, wasn't it? And I was like,
but that is,
when is this going to get going?
But that's golf. Like, that is the traditions of golf. What you saw on the 72nd hole when Tiger wins and all the sports fans are chanting his name, that's what Tiger Woods has brought in. It's similar to Happy Gilmore when, you know, they're giving out about Happy Gilmore and what he's bringing to the game and they don't like it. But because sports fans or golf fans are meant, the old style golf fans are meant to just sit there and clap, but
without
now it's a bit more boisterous. Yeah. But he's the Masters champion now, fifth time, 22 years on from winning his first green jacket. It still fits. And the 43-year-old carded a final round 70. So he finished up on 13 under, one clear of fellow Americans Dustin Johnson, Xander Schauffele and Brooks Koepka. Woods missed the 2016 and 2017 Masters with back problems. He obviously underwent back fusion surgery in April of 2017. And whoever did that surgery, I'd say, felt pretty happy about things when he won yesterday. Rory McIlroy wasn't his week, but he did shoot a good score yesterday. Finished just outside the top 20 on 5 under par. So as this was all going on, I was double screening it, trying to watch the Premier League as well. And
double screening?
Yeah. Had to do it.
How does that
Well, what I did was I had the football on the TV and I had the iPad and I had a headphone in my ear. So if something mad happened in the golf, I could then turn to watch that screen as well.
Try doing all that while trying to study anatomy.
Yeah, exactly. And it's tough.
Why I know nothing about anything. Yeah. I'll be in an exam on Thursday talking about
Mo Salah's goal.
Yeah.
And the anatomy.
Yeah. Well, Mo Salah's goal was the standout moment yesterday. Liverpool still 2 points clear at the top of the Premier League. They've 4 games to play. Jurgen Klopp's side beat Chelsea 2-0. That goal from Salah came after Sadio Mane had opened the scoring. City had gone top for a few hours with a 3-1 win at Crystal Palace. Raheem Sterling, you talked about him with Gary Breen. He scored twice. Gabriel Jesus made sure of the 3 points. The City have played a game less. Pep Guardiola thinks his side are going to have to win their last 5 games. Jurgen Klopp says all Liverpool can do is win their last 4. If they come up short with 97 points, he says they can't be accused of failing.
What we want to do is to collect as many points as possible. Really, I don't know what is now 85, 4 games to play, means 97. Good, let's try that. And if that's enough, perfect. And if not, we cannot change it. And we didn't lose it here or there or whatever in this or that game. There will, but very smart people will come out and say, yeah, if you would have won against Leicester, then you would be champion now, stuff like that. It's all bullshit.
Yeah, Jurgen dropping the B word there. But it's the race for the top 4 tonight that we'll be focusing on. Arsenal can go 4th if they win away to Watford. Arsenal haven't got the best away record at the moment. Also, 4 games in the SSC Electricity League Premier Division. The champions Dundalk, who were beaten at the weekend, host 2nd place Bohemians. Cork City are away to UCD. St Pat's face Derry City. And Sligo Rovers take on Waterford. All those games kick off at 7.45. The Arsenal and Watford one is an 8 o'clock start. Celtic beat Aberdeen 3-0 in their Scottish Cup semi-final. They'll play Hearts in the final next month. Israel Folau has been sacked by Rugby Australia for his homophobic social media post, which said homosexuals, drunks and atheists would burn in hell if they don't repent. His employer said the post breached their professional players' code of conduct. Folau has 48 hours to accept the sanction or face a code of conduct hearing. And one thing that happened over the weekend, Dennis Hogan, the Irish boxer, he's based in Brisbane from Kildare. He was in a world title fight for the first time in Mexico. He went into the backyard of the champion, WBO champion, Jaime Munguia. Great performance from Hogan, a 20-1 outsider. Goes to the scorecards, you're thinking he's won. They read out 114, 114 each, 115, 113, 116, 112. You're waiting to hear, and the new champion didn't happen.
There's
still, yeah. Golden boy, Munguia, gets the decision. Heartbreak for Hogan. He'll probably get a rematch. And just finally, yeah, it was really hard. Like, it didn't surprise me. But just before I go, if you're going to go racing in Tramore today, don't bother. It's been cancelled.
Okay.
You always go out to the seaside as well.
You can go to the seaside.
Damien McKenzie is out for 8 to 9 months to Kiwi. He's ruptured his ACL seemingly, so that's news coming in on the rugby front as well.
Brilliant. More brilliant news to start off.
Probably not bad news for New Zealand's rivals, I guess.
Well, exactly. Well, we won't go there yet. But speaking of New Zealand, we have Ronan O'Gara on the line, but he's not in New Zealand. It's a bye week in the Super League, so Ronan is on holidays in Fiji this morning. Speaking of Tramore, I don't know what I prefer, to be on holidays in Tramore or Fiji, but Ronan, since you're here and we're talking about Galway this morning, what's your Galway, best Galway memory?
The Galway races or going to Galway?
In general, what's your favourite thing about Galway? Since myself and Johnny Ward are here, we've taken over and we spent the morning talking about how great it is to be from Galway, and we're blessed. You're not blessed, but you get to come on holiday there every once in a while. What's your favourite part of it?
I've been to Galway many times. Both my parents are West of Ireland people, Mayo and Sligo. So going back 30 years, we were packed into the car in an 8 to 10 hour journey up those roads. I think we bypassed Galway always, but I've cousins in Galway, the Lillises, 10 children, good healthy
just
family.
Just the 10.
Pre-contraception those days.
So, what a great place to go, Galway. Yeah, I love going to Galway. But the problem is, when you were playing professional rugby for as long as I was, you don't appreciate it. It's just like another hotel, another town, and out to the dog track for hopefully a 3-0 victory for Munster was usually the scoreline in our days, you know. So, it is a great city.
I have to bring up one thing, which if you are in Fiji, could you not have done a little bit better in terms of the imagery in the background than
Aren't you on a beach?
It's 9 o'clock, is it, or it's 8 o'clock? I had to whip the kids off the table here and said I have to go on the radio now. And Dad, if you're on the radio, why do you need us? They don't need to see you. And I said, no, it's the new radio, so I don't really get the Skype. So, I know. I should post a thing or two, but that's not really my scene. What a beautiful, beautiful country. Amazing people. And have a down week. So, Scott Robertson, who's the boss of the Crusaders, a few contacts out here. So we all decided we'd come out for a week. We're playing here, actually, on the 1st of June against the Chiefs. So I'm not doing any recce for that. It's a complete holiday.
Would they recognise you, actually, the Fijians out there?
Yeah, they do, yeah. It's amazing, all right. They're Ryan O'Gara or something. No, Ronan O'Gara.
No, you're grand. It's grand. Ryan will do.
It's a cross between Ronan and Brian. You know, it's Ronan,
well, look, welcome to my life.
Jeepers,
I spend my life explaining my name. So if you're getting Ryan O'Gara in Fiji, you're not doing too badly. But Kamir, the big story breaking overnight there, here for us, and I'm sure you guys are interested, is Israel Folau. Who have we got there now?
Bruna, my wife has come in. She's from the three outside. She went out to the garden.
But fair play to her for actually going outside, unlike you.
Yes.
I like the way he says Galway races clobber for the year.
That's your hat now for Ladies' Day on Thursday and Galway races.
But your Galway races that's not till when? August?
August, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he's taking away the hat now. He doesn't want to let the ladies know of the
competition. No, I do. I just gotta.
But come here, back to actual rugby. Israel Folau, the story's just come in from BBC Sport that apparently Australia end his contract over his anti-gay messages and rhetoric. It was only ever going to go that way, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, exactly. And I'm not trying to kick at the touch, but I think, you know what I mean? Just the more you talk about this, the more, I suppose, he gets oxygen and the more he probably wants to achieve what he wanted to out of this. But, I think it comes back to a lack of respect for everyone within rugby. It's great to have values and it's great to have strong values, but the most important thing I think you learn when you go into a team is you learn about respect, and I don't think these comments or his comments are respectful. And it's particularly disappointing, I suppose, considering especially what happened in Christchurch, with an essential, I'm a fantastic rugby player and a role model, to come out with comments like that, it's not acceptable in this day and age.
It will have, funnily enough, even on this side of the world, reverberations as such, because of what Billy Vunipola also kind of weighed into it. And obviously, Champions Cup weekend is coming up next, and, he may or may not play now.
Billy Vunipola might play, will he not?
Well, he came off the bench for Saracens, but, you'd be thinking if Israel's been getting the heave-ho, you'd imagine Billy's also going to be getting, at the very least, a very stern word.
I presume so. I presume he'd be pulled aside, or he has been pulled aside. He'll have to probably release a statement, but I presume
they're saying they're taking the matter very seriously and will be handled internally, while the Rugby Football Union will meet the England forward next week to discuss the social media posts.
Yeah, but I think that obviously in Saracens is probably good teammates around him, and he needs to probably decide exactly what road he wants to go down. But I presume Falau, probably the difference with him is probably he has an option of playing league, he has an option of playing AFL. So in terms of the contract terminated, I wouldn't say that's too big an issue for him. But Billy Vunipola, I think one of Saracen's strengths is probably they are very united, they are very strong in their stick-togetherness. So I think I presume by liking a comment, he probably come out with a statement saying that he probably distanced himself from that, and business will be resumed.
Well, from what I can gather, he quite doubled down. He was very, very vehement in supporting Israel Folau's right to have his opinion.
Well, like, this is the thing, my take on this, for what it's worth, Ronan. Like, I totally defend anyone to the right of free speech and the right to your own opinion. But in the context of something like this, and I don't know if you came across many sort of gay rugby players when you played, can you imagine a gay rugby player who's in the closet and, he's maybe thinking of how best I'm going to deal with this in a macho environment, and then you've to deal with this sort of stuff coming out, and you have references to hell and all of this, and just how difficult that must be for that type of person.
Yeah, exactly, Johnny, but even more so, I think what brings it even more home for me, I thought about it earlier on today, I have four boys, okay, so there could come a day in 10 years time or less than that one of them goes to me, Dad, I'm gay, okay, so then you have someone that's I suppose as influential as Israel Folau, and he's posting that one of my kids, if they were gay, will go to hell. You wouldn't feel great as a dad having to deal with that. There's just no need for that. And it's not warranted, and it's not respectful to what we learn in school, in life, in general. I think it's great to have strong beliefs, but you'd be driven, and having beliefs is very different. But I think from my point of view, it steps over the line grossly, and it's completely disrespectful for what we all essentially stand for.
It's certainly, every once in a while, in sport, and we've just been saying all day really how sport, it doesn't matter at all, but it also matters a great amount. And sometimes the news outside the sport can become kind of encapsulate what's actually happening in the sport. And because of Israel Folau and all the kerfuffle there in the last week, you'd nearly forget that we're coming up to Champions Cup semi-finals. We've got a really good weekend coming up.
Yeah, you do, exactly. And that's the most important thing. He is a high-profile individual, and he is, I think there's no one in the game with aerial skills, but unfortunately, we're not talking about anything got to do with the pitch. And you are right, and I think especially in a small country like Ireland, sports stars are hugely influential, and they are role models. And what they say sometimes becomes hugely important, but in this case it's turned extremely sour, and I don't think it should be represented, because it's so tough if you were very strong-willed and you had, I suppose, a good network around you in terms of how do you deal with this from a point of view that gay people are going to hell. It just makes, in this day and age, it just makes absolutely no sense.
And we have, next weekend, we actually have live commentary on Saracens. They're going to be taking on Munster, obviously, over there. We're going to have live commentary here on Off the Ball. I'd imagine that will become a factor with all the stuff now with Believe in a Poll as well in the background. That might be something that Munster might be able to harness, especially if it turns out that he may end up not playing or coming off the bench, or at the very least, psychologically use it against Saracens.
Yeah, I think it's a great week as a Munster rugby player these weeks. I think I was kind of getting my thoughts together before I came on air. I was lucky enough to play in 10 of these European Cup semi-finals, which obviously the success rate or the transfer rate wasn't great, but to play in 10 of them, we were really consistent. We probably lacked a little bit of a cutting edge, no doubt about that. But I think to play in a semi-final, it's a great, great week. You really, really get excited because you're essentially 80 minutes away from getting to the big day out, and that's special in itself. So I think this morning there will be a pep in the Munster boys' step, irrespective of having a great performance against Treviso at the weekend. Now you have kind of 38 people that feel very valued and feel very probably on top of their game from sending out essentially a B team to Treviso and getting a bonus point win against them. So there will be, internally, the guys that played there, they kind of half be hoping their name will be read out in the team, but it probably won't be. But that's not a bad thing either, just having that genuine competition for places. Saracens, yes, they are favourites, no doubt about that. But as you've seen with England going to the Aviva on the first day, no one really gave them a chance and they blitzed Ireland. Are many people giving Munster a chance? I think deep down, not really. But it's set up for beautifully for Munster to just tip away under the radar, use the Billy Vunipola stuff in whatever way they want to their advantage, just keep it there at arm's length and have a kind of a really smash and grab plan up their sleeve and hopefully go in there and do the business.
I'll be working actually at the Leinster v Toulouse game here on Saturday. That's going to be here in Dublin. I know Toulouse came here a few months ago and we were expecting a good game and it just they collapsed completely. It was just Leinster kind of steamrolled them. I can't imagine the same thing's going to happen this weekend on Easter Sunday.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it can, Maura. I think it can easily. Because
what do I know?
No, not in that regard.
From Galway run.
And I spent 5 years there and that's I just think the behavioural traits of French teams, you know, I think minimum it takes 21 days to change a habit. So what happens in top 14 is that they're very ill-disciplined and their capacity to crack under a modicum of pressure, it gets to them. This is semi-final. This is the Aviva. This is in Dublin, away from home. Yes, Toulouse are having a season better than anyone could have expected, but is it in their heads, are they in bonus territory already? If you're in bonus territory before you're taking on Leinster, you're in big, big trouble. But I think what probably hasn't been mentioned, I think this Reggie Sonnis, who was the director of rugby in Bandon Grammar and in the Bandon school, is now coaching Toulouse. And he was extremely popular in West Cork and I think left a big imprint down there. And now he's the forwards coach with Toulouse. And I think everyone is raving about him. So that's a kind of a nice, I suppose, subplot to the fact that Toulouse have great history in the Champions Cup and they're a hugely successful team. But it's, you know, it's... I don't think the aura around Leinster is as strong as it was 6 months ago. You look at it maybe after, was it the first round of when they, and I was actually in the ground when they played Wasps in the RDS. Was it the first game of round one?
It was, yeah.
Was extremely, extremely good. And I left the ground going, well, it'll take an incredible team to beat them. But I think they are beatable.
Where are the deficiencies there now, Ronan?
Pardon me?
Where are the deficiencies in Leinster at the moment?
Well, there's deficiencies. The reality is, Johnny, there's deficiencies everywhere. If you get 10 points your game and you rattle them, it's the same as, you know, before Ireland went to play in England, I wouldn't have been able to give you many deficiencies. But like physicality, slowing up Ireland's ruck ball, not letting them play, stopping them after two phases, not probably seeing the space for kick space. So what applies in green applies in blue. So I think in that regard, Leinster will have to play well, irrespective of them being at home, to beat Toulouse, because Toulouse play differently to a lot of teams, and the fact that they chance their arm, even though it is semi-final rugby, a lot of teams would be very structured, but Toulouse will actually really play an offload game. And when you play an offload game, if that clicks, they could be dangerous. But if it becomes wishy-washy, it'll be very, very manageable for Leinster.
A team that would have been many a time accused of being wishy-washy, sometimes not their own fault, they just didn't have the supports and funding and stuff. And since we're from Galway, we may as well talk about them. Connacht, what a weekend. Like, it's just a great story.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's been building. I think their building blocks have been getting stronger. You know, I don't have the nitty-gritty of what happens internally there, but watching from afar, I know that they have seemed to have a coach that people, he appeals to the public in Galway, which is very important. I think they've always played for each other. They've got a strong manager. I think they've made some good appointments off the pitch. They've got Eric Elwood, who's a legend down there, back involved. Gavin Duffy is very popular there, but they probably have competition for places like they haven't had in the past, and you need that more. You need, you know what I mean, 2-1 in at least 10 positions. Otherwise, you don't have a chance. And I think, you know, I mean, the pressure was on them at the weekend to get a result against Cardiff, and to be able to do that speaks volumes for them. And Ireland and the game in Ireland really need a strong Connacht. And what they did in Murrayfield, beating Leinster a few years ago, I think it's probably underappreciated. You know, we talk about Tiger Woods last night, but what Connacht did in Twickenham, it wasn't Murrayfield, in Twickenham in the final, was incredible. A sporting occasion and a sporting achievement. And they obviously had a few change of coaches since then, but the buzz seems to be back, and the West is awake, and there's no place like the West for getting in behind them, because obviously GAA is huge out in the West of Ireland, and I think there's a huge appeal for that. But I think Connacht rugby now is alive and well, and it's great that they probably have someone like Jack Carty, who's driving it, who's always been a really skillful player, but probably has got a lot more of a backbone than a lot of other players have, and that's really fantastic to see.
You mentioned Tiger Woods there. Were you watching him? Did you have time on the beach in Fiji?
No, I was asleep and I missed everything, and I woke up.
He won anyway.
Of course he won, but jeez, I think I'm in my 40s, so I've kind of grown up watching this guy and idolising this guy. And, there's a great quote, I think, about adversity causes most people to break, others break records. Mm. And that was the one thing that sprung to mind. And I think, you know, I've seen it. I saw his winning put, obviously, just on Twitter. But I think to have, you know what I mean, it just sums up. Golf is very different because it's a mental game, and you know, I mean, Father Time doesn't really catch in golf as much as it would in other sports. But I think, you know, for me, the key learnings out of it are is that it's just the mind is so powerful, and it's your area more, it's less of your.
Well, sometimes my mind is just shook altogether these days. I don't know whether I'm coming or going. But listen, thanks very much for your time, though. We do appreciate it. We're going to let you go now. Yeah. You can get your flowers together. You can get your hat ready for the races in Galway. Myself and Johnny Ward will take you.
Any update on his horse, actually?
Yeah, on his
week
horse.
To week, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
No, sure. I get the old talk and text from Joseph, and all he's doing now is I see he's making appointments and he's hired Brendan Powell in the last 24 hours, which seems to be a shrewd signing. But no, I think I mentioned you, Johnny, all right. And oh, yeah, some fella, but sure, there's no mention of my horse, Johnny. So you might be, he said he was on the show. So when you're on to him next, we'll get in a bit of info. My man, Paul was down at, Paul Shannon was in the sales in Sydney. So I'm waiting for an update, but
we keep you posted.
Yeah, we'll keep the faith. We'll keep the faith. Well, we'll be back for summer racing.
I'm definitely looking forward to see what Ronan O'Gara Milnery comes up now with the hats over the next few months. Ronan, thanks a million for your time. We'll have John Duggan in studio next, Talking Tiger Woods. We're going to leave the rugby for at the moment with this. This is Alan Quinlan's take on Israel Folau from last Friday's OTB AM.
Who the hell is Israel Folau to tell people that they're going to hell? That just because he believes it, because he's read it in a book somewhere. It's absolute bullshit. And I met the guy last summer in Australia and seemed like a very nice guy. He was very open. I interviewed him, really polite. He seemed good with all the kids around the after the game, standing in for photos, very, very polite to everyone. But, you know, he's telling people they're going to hell for all these sins. It's not his job to start preaching that rubbish to people. And you know, people should be allowed to be who they are. We're all sinners, probably, you know, in the eyes of our Lord. But, you
well,
know,
yeah, and his version of a sin is...
Well, you're going to hell if you sin. And that's not what I've been taught in
Well, I take issue with his version of what a sin actually is. Like, rugby obviously has an opportunity, Quinny, to do something here, right? Like, they have an opportunity to take a stance against one of the most high-profile international players in the game right now. Do you think they take that? I mean, as a game?
I think here, the issue here is freedom of speech and all that is fine, but if you're employed by someone and you're representing not just his own people in Australia and the Waratahs, but essentially he's representing everybody who plays the code of rugby union. And to be fair, we can all talk about values and good values and stuff like that, but I 99.9% of people, I think, in rugby would think that this is discrimination against people.
There you go. It's certainly one of these stories of the week. But the bigger story at the moment is Tiger Woods. John Duggan is here joining us. You've been busy scribbling this morning.
More Tressa and Johnny, good morning. Yeah, I've just done an article on offtheball.com about my thoughts on Tiger Woods and what it symbolises and represents. And it was just one of the greatest days I've ever witnessed in sport. It's not hyperbole for me to say that. I am a golf fan, but that was a sporting story for the ages. One of the greatest comebacks in the history of sport. Of course, you can talk about Niki Lauda or Muhammad Ali or Offaly in 94. But that was just incredible. That was just brilliant.
What makes it better than Muhammad Ali? Because for me, in my head, that's the best sporting comeback ever.
I think timing. Muhammad Ali was, I know he was 32 when he knocked out Foreman and Zaire. But Woods has been 11 years out of the major circle.
And I didn't realise the extent of his back problems.
He could hardly walk. Yeah, he could hardly walk. Like, you're talking about somebody who could hardly walk. Not only returning to the PGA Tour and then winning a tournament, the Tour Championship last year, but then winning a major, the Masters, beating Brooks Koepka and Francesco Molinari, who've won the last three majors. So that to me is just, look, obviously he's got good physicians in that. But just from a mental point of view, like Butch Harmon, the coach of Woods for the first eight major titles that he won, has always said this great line that Nicholas is the greatest champion. And I think champion is not just your achievements, it's how you conduct yourself, it's how ambassadorial you are. But Woods is the most talented player to ever play the game.
That would be my issue. I just find it very, very difficult. I mean, I understand what he's achieved is great. To me, I'm not sure anything is ever going to overcome all the other stuff he's done. Now, that's just me and my own personal opinion. People may say, who cares what she thinks? And that's absolutely true. He doesn't care what I think. Absolutely not. But I don't know if I've seen enough good out of him as a person to appreciate the greatness he's achieved.
to me, I can separate the two.
But can you, though? Is that right? Can you separate? I mean, it was things like he was caught, like, with the DUI, for example. I just think that's reprehensible. We were talking about Israel Folau earlier and what he said, which is also reprehensible. I just do sometimes wonder, like, has Tiger Woods done enough? Has he apologised enough? Has he done enough good things? I don't know, because we haven't seen it in him. Do we need to see it in him? Maybe we don't. Maybe we do. I think I personally need to see it.
I don't need to see it. Because I can separate Tiger Woods, the person, from what he has achieved as a golfer, which is magical and otherworldly. And also, I don't really care about if Tiger Woods is a nice guy or not today. I don't think he's a particularly nice guy. Mm-hmm. What I do care about is that I think there are a lot of people out there struggling in life, and I think that a lot of people look at life through a black and white lens because of things that happen to them. And I've been one of those people, and everybody's been through tough times and ups and downs. That's what life's about. Life's about peaks and troughs, right?
Life is grey.
Life is grey. And, you know, for example, my best friend died 3 years ago. So I went through a lot of black and white moments. And luckily enough, and very, you know, I was blessed to have the experience of a World Cup to see the colour and joy in life again. And I think that if you look at Tiger Woods as a symbol of somebody who's been public property since he was, you know, a small boy, he was on the, was it the Mike Douglas show or something at 4 years of age. He was just somebody who completely changed race relations in ways, brought golf into the mainstream of American sport and commercialized American sport, and was public property. And at the age of 21, wins the Masters by 12 shots. So everything he does is scrutinized, and then he puts up this front for his whole life, and he never really had a life. And then what happens is you have his private life everywhere, all over the place, the humiliation of that. If he wasn't married, would people have treated that differently?
Well, obviously, because he wouldn't have been cheating then. He would have just been a man who had a lot of experience.
Then
you have the arrest a couple of years ago. His mugshot all over the world. People are saying, you know what, that's very sad.
Yeah, it is.
He's to be pitied. He's going to slip into obscurity and possibly privacy, and we'll never see him again. And all Tiger Woods was great. Remember him. So to me, I don't care if he's a nice guy or not. I don't think he's a nice guy. But for me, it's a symbol of what redemption is about from a personal level, that you can come back, that you can make it, that if you're seeing life in black and white, you can see colour again and you can achieve things, even if through the whole world are seeing a mugshot and going, you know what, we got pity on this guy now, that he can reconstruct his body and then win the Masters 11 years after his last major. So that was my kind of thinking about separating the things and looking at him as a symbol of somebody that can come back from adversity and triumph.
He makes some very good points there now.
If
you go back to Charles Stewart Parnell and the scandal of that time when Charles Stewart Parnell and his relationship with that woman and so forth, and it basically split the party and all that. Now we've a situation where we've a guy who was obviously a serial cheater on his wife, yet is absolutely the subject of mass adulation years later because he comes back. And people just accept that he's flawed and that you can make these mistakes in your personal life, and ultimately we'll give you redemption because you're flawed.
I think the cheating on the wife and stuff, not saying it's fine, but it's his personal business. For me, what people do in their own personal lives, it doesn't bother me. What kind of I didn't like about the man was that book, say Joe Malloy was discussing that kind of thing. He's just not nice to people. Now maybe that's changed, but I just think it's really interesting, John, what you said about how you went to the World Cup and it gave colour to your life and that kind of stuff. And I think sometimes we don't see colour, and when colour comes, you really have to grab it and enjoy it, whatever that is for that person.
Well, a lot of people can see colour in their day-to-day and nothing goes wrong for them. And I was somebody that, you know, nothing really went wrong for me in my life, and then something went very terribly wrong. And I know what it's like to see a black and white, like life through black and white. And then when you see colour again, you're going, oh my God, now I've seen it for a second time. And I don't want to get too personal about it, but it just, to me, it was a symbol of... It's not easy being people are going, we even discussed with Adrian Barry the other day, why aren't Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka polished media performers? These people are athletes, they're golfers. I don't think Alex Higgins was necessarily the nicest person in the world at times, but he was a flawed genius.
Everyone loved George Best.
Everybody loved George Best. Gazza. Gazza to me has done things that are much worse than Tiger Woods. But you can even see the outpouring of emotion for him when he came on in that Tottenham game before the new stadium was opened. So,
just on that as well, John, it's so much, as Joe said, it goes back to your youth. Like, and Gazza's youth was so, so troubled in terms of things that happened when he was developing as a young man. And you have to seed something of your emotion in terms of Tiger, because of, he's such a tricky upbringing. And he never had a normal life, really. And it's inevitable that things would go wrong for him, and that, you know, you would have some evidence of what went wrong.
Well, he was living his life through his father's vision.
Doing what his dad wanted.
You know, so we're in an army kind of situation, which generally I don't think they were that well off. Mm. There's racism, and like this is what you're going to be. This is what you're going to be, son. You're going to be the best golfer in the world. You're going to be a superstar. You're going to be, and he never had a life. So was I surprised when it all went wrong? You could even see Tiger Woods around that time before the sex scandal, the unhappiness of him on the course, cussing and being angry about shots, and you see the kind of the bad behaviour. And like, was it that Padraig Harrington would have said that we never saw Tiger Woods? Mm. We just thought he was a lonely guy who went to his hotel room.
But to be devil's advocate, you could say lots of people have had really horrible upbringings and they still grow up to be, at the very least, polite people.
We're not all the same, though.
No, we're not. Yeah.
And I'm not trying to make apologies for Tiger Woods as a person. I don't know the guy, and from all the evidence, I think they're probably nicer people out there. But as well, when I've covered golf tournaments, golfers come across as so polite and so genteel, and it's all about the gentlemanly aspect of the game. These guys live in a bubble. These guys live in a selfish individual bubble, and it's all about them. And like, you know, team sports is a rarity. It happens every couple of years at the Ryder Cup. I'm trying to separate the Tiger Woods as a person, right, from the genius we saw over the last 4 days, culminating in that you knew that when Molinari hit it in the drink, Woods is not going to, he's not going to let him get away with this. He's going to birdie 13, he's going to birdie 15, and then Michael Phelps behind him, he nearly aces the 16th. You just knew this guy's going to finish this with utter unbelievable bottle. And as I said, it's a symbol of, for anybody out there struggling, that this guy was gone. He couldn't hardly walk. He had 4 back surgeries. His mugshot's all over the world. You are finished, son. You're a symbol of shame. Whereas I think now today, Tiger Woods is a symbol of what can happen if you persist.
Did you feel sorry for Molinari?
No.
No.
He's won his major.
Yeah.
Tiger's Day.
I felt
no, but it's sorry it's like the All Blacks when they beat Ireland in 2013. I know we beat them last year. They had to play the ball from, you know, their own half, and they didn't miss a beat, and they scored. They were, you know, pure champion. And Stephen Hendry, Jimmy White missed the black in 94. Stephen Hendry, you knew he was not going to miss. And there is something you have to admire about whatever a person's flaws are, how they're nice or not they are, that somebody can just absolutely execute. And we knew that Tiger Woods, even the way he dresses, he knows that, you know, I'm going to intimidate you the way I dress on a Sunday. And just to see that come back after all these years, it's like Bobby Ewing in the shower in Dallas. It's like he'd never gone away.
John, when you write, I always really enjoy it. Where can people go and find your article? Where we send them?
Offtheball.com. It's on the golf section of the website. Just to synopsize what I've just said here right now. All these kind of stats are going to come out. $2 million in prize money, 15 majors, Jack's got 18, 6th in the world, was 1,199th. 4 back surgeries, all this kind of thing. To me, just what I'm taking up from it personally is, for anybody out there, you can go through hell, but there can be a better day ahead. And I think that Tiger Woods for me this morning is a symbol of that. And like, there are not many better comebacks. Ali, as you said, Niki Lauda, Ben Hogan as well in the game. But let's rejoice and celebrate a brilliant day in sport that's not going to be repeated very soon.
I think you're right in one aspect, John, in that there's not enough colour in this world. And if you can grab a bit of happiness, because you never know what's around the corner, you should take it. So thanks very much for your time.
All right, guys.
We have an amazing competition for you here all week on OTBAM, with thanks to Turkish Airlines. They're the proud sponsors of Cricket Ireland. Ireland is facing the busiest summer of cricket we've ever known, hosting some of the biggest teams in the world, such as England, the West Indies and Bangladesh. Cricket Ireland are also hosting Zimbabwe and Afghanistan later in the summer. On May 5th, the Ireland men's team will face England in Malahide, with a tri-series against Bangladesh and West Indies to follow. And here at OTBAM, we're giving you the chance to fly anywhere in the world with Turkish Airlines. To enter, just head to the link we've tweeted and post in our live stream as well for OTBAM and fill in the entry form. The link there, you will find it on all our feeds. So get yourselves there if you want to travel anywhere in the world. Of course, the big story is Tiger Woods and everything that's going on. And now to go for a psychological aspect, I'm going to bring on one of my old military, actually, in UL, Dr. Mark Campbell. He's a sports psychologist with a huge interest in golf and has done a lot of research in the world of golf and worked with elite golfers. Mark Campbell, tell us, is Tiger Woods, is this the greatest redemption story you've ever seen?
Good morning, Muratrasa. Yeah, I think it was exceptional, really, wasn't it? Just looking at the... just looking at that back nine, he was just so serene and in control, wasn't he? It was just an exceptional Masters moment.
If you were working with Tiger Woods or somebody who's gone through that kind of amount of personal stuff and health stuff and injuries and psychological trauma and physical trauma, where would you even start trying to help them put themselves back together again?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what he's been through, a lot of it's self-inflicted, as you know, but... I think it would be a real step-by-step process. You know, I think he struggled for so long there with different injuries and different other bits and parts. I think, you know, what you could do there would be a real step-by-step process. And, you know, he's obviously done a lot of therapy and, you know, he had some addiction issues and things like that. So he's kind of very self-aware. He always has been. But, you know, it was more performance-oriented early in his career, and I think now it's more kind of person-centered. It's more about him and where he's going, and, you know, like you say there, a bit of colour or a bit of happiness or kind of positivity.
Do you think that the family aspect is finally coming through? Because for a long time, you wouldn't even know, unless you knew about his personal life, you wouldn't have known he was married with two children. We didn't see them, we didn't hear about them. It was just Tiger the machine, whereas yesterday the children were front and centre. Is that on purpose?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to know. They weren't there for the tournament. They just they just came on Sunday afternoon. So I think it was nice to have them there. I think it really topped it off for Tiger. But yeah, I'm not sure. I think he's quite good at separating out different parts of his life, even family and kids and things like that. So it did look good. It certainly looked good for the media, yeah.
It looked good, but like... does it make a difference to him? I just find him such an interesting character. I wouldn't even know where to start trying to not break him down, but get in, I suppose, and find out what he's thinking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's, you know, what makes Tiger separate from other people? You know, he's not the most popular guy in the world. He's not the nicest guy in the world by all accounts, but he's just an exceptional performer, and we don't see his like too often. And, you know, in relation to his kids there, I think he's very, you know, he's a very serious parent. He's very, you know, he's kind of humbled the last few years. So he's all about family now and, you know, his private life and things like that. So it was great to kind of see that outpouring of emotion at the end there, because he was so serene and controlled all day, you know, on the golf course. So just to see the opposite of that afterwards was really nice, really special, kind of heartwarming, you know.
I guess with just Mark, with Rory McIlroy, if you were to perform some sort of psychological appraisal of him, he wakes up this morning, what do you say to him?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for most golfers, 20th or 5-under at the Masters is a pretty good week. But for Rory, it's, yeah, it's just another small setback, I think. He played some very good golf. He just couldn't put it all together. And I think... he'll be back to the drawing board a little bit. You know, he talked very well in the run-up to the Masters. He played really well. He was very in charge of his kind of mental game. He was talking about processes and, you know, the result isn't going to determine the kind of person he is and things like that. So it was quite clear he had been doing some, you know, mental work or working with a psychologist or whatever that might be. But, yeah, I think it's just hard to put it all together in the 1 week. And I think, you know, maybe for Rory, he just builds up the Masters to be just the biggest event for him. And if he just played it like it was any other week, or if he had more of that approach, he might see a little more benefits there. So, you know, it's hard. I think he gets caught up in the media side of it and the hype and things like that. It's very difficult, but he needs to separate himself out a bit more if he can, you know.
How do you manage that? Like, when you're the likes of Rory McIlroy and you've got this media circus around you, like, what do you even do to try and keep that away from your head and your mind when you're going into, I mean, whatever but any other sport, golf goes on for a long time.
Yeah, it does, you know, and four days over the Masters, that's why we love watching it, I think. You know, the tension builds day to day to day, but, you know, I think for Rory and for Tiger and these people, they just need a semblance of normal life, you know, family around, wives, partners, girlfriends. And just, you know, they rent houses and they you know, play computer games, and they try and just closet themselves off and away from those kind of headlines and the hype around that. So I think, like, the team you have around you is very important sometimes to just normalize everything and make it look like it's, you know, it's just another game of golf. It's just another performance. There's nothing special to it. It's a special venue and a great week, but those are for, you know, reviews and looking back over them, really. It isn't for kind of that staying in the present and in the moment and just being really just normal, normalized kind of stuff. The team around you can really benefit that, you know, they can create that situation.
Would I be right in saying then that you'd be erring on the side of, if you were working with a golfer at the Masters, that you'd be thinking just avoid media, don't go near them at all, rather than allow that to get into your head on such a big week?
Yeah, well, I think obviously they have some kind of media duties and things like that. They need to do some interviews and things, but I guess you can manage that and you can not get caught up in it. And, you know, he's trying to just play a good week of a tournament. He's just trying to put four good scores together. So I think it's that idea of trying to stay present and trying to jump ahead. You know, like, journalists will always be asking you about, you know, it'll be special to win this week, or you're only two back, three back, whatever it might be. But, you know, he just needs to try and center themselves and just stay more kind of in that kind of present moment and try to not get too caught up in the press. But they do have to do some press, obviously, otherwise, you know, people wouldn't be happy. So,
and I know we had a bit of a crack with Ron O'Gara about the Skype kind of scene that he set, but Dr. Mark is very interesting because, like, stony grey walls, you know, it's like, I'm going to be very level here, this is how it is.
They're the offices in UL upstairs in the Pess building. I remember them well. Many a time I'd be called
in. No paint, no plastering, nothing going on. It's like, this is my office, ignore the walls, this is the, you know, this is where we are.
It's the grey jumper with the grey walls too, yeah.
Mm.
Is that done for you, Mark, in a way to make sure there's nothing infiltrating anybody's thoughts when they come into your office? It's just grey and therefore it's just an open space for thought.
Absolutely, yeah, you got it more, Tracy. You were in here once.
Great, twice, well, so. Listen, Mark, thank you very much for your time. That's Dr. Mark Campbell there, a sports psychologist who does a lot of work with golfers. And we have just all we've left to say now is thanks very much for joining us. We had a great morning here on OTB AM.
We
had a great time, Johnny. I won't let you say to anyone you didn't. You had the best morning of your life here with me.
My highlight was you really clasping that warm mug, you know, and that kind of lovely manner of, you know,
my this mug.
Yeah, it's just when you
hugging my mug.
There's a lot to be said for a cup of tea or a cup of coffee in the morning. Just
it's really fancy. It's got froth and everything.
Yeah,
Tommy Rooney. I mean, he may be interrupting me a lot when I'm talking, but he's also very. Oh, it wasn't Tommy. Sorry, I thought it was Tommy who made my coffee. It was Jake, sorry.
And well, Jake did a nice job on the coffee.
Thanks be to God for Jake, because if it wasn't for him, I'd be fueled on nothing. I'd had a Diet Coke and a Kit Kat like
I'm not sure about the thanks be to God thing. You know, we need to keep the divine out of things at the moment. Very controversial many ways. Going to hell and all this nonsense, you know, just let's deal with facts.
Well, I'm definitely going to hell for some of the things I've done over my life. But anyway, we'll not go there now. Listen, that's a good place to say. That's all good for us at the moment now. That's from OTB AM this morning. Thanks very much. Off the Ball is back again at 7 o'clock tonight with Joe, Richie and the rest of the gang. They'll be talking about some lad called Tiger Woods, rugby, football, and also, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, go check out our new show Off the Wall, and Andy Lee is starring in that as well. They're off on their Game of Thrones tour around up around Northern Ireland. We'll be reviewing episode 1 of season 8 later today across Off the Ball. I wouldn't recognise anyone from Game of Thrones. I've zero interest. And here's Andy with Liam Cunningham, who plays Sir Davos Seaworth, whoever he is in the series.
Liam, thank you very much. Tell us about your time playing Sir Davos. You know, how he developed from, like, this kind of secondary character. Now he's one of the main men.
Well, you know what? I think the producers got to like him because there's so much, I use the term moral ambiguity in this. In other words, there's some bad swines in this show, right? And they kind of needed something. I mean, he's been described as the moral compass of the piece, you know, and I always think he spoke up for the audience.
Yeah,
that's how I felt about him, that he was kind of going, you can't do this madness, this is bad, whatever you're trying to do.
There's been several times in the show when you've made huge speeches to the Iron Bank, to the Northerners behalf of Kings that really swayed it, wasn't it?
He speaks the truth and he speaks simply, you know, and he's from a very humble beginnings, but he's never overwhelmed by any of this. He's only overwhelmed when people want to do the wrong things for what they think is the right reasons. Mm. And, you know, that kind of holds the mirror up to society in a way, you know what I mean?
How do you think he will react when he sees, if he sees, Melisandre again? You'll be doing a bit of boxing
that's
yourself.
I might be coming out of retirement myself.
Tell me, you said he's not a fighter. You know, he's he said himself, I'm not a fighter, but will he see any action, do you think, in season 8?
I'm hearing rumours there there might be a lot of action in season 8. Anything more than that, I'd have to kill both of us.
Liam, thanks very much.
Nice talking to you.
Pleasure, Derek.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.